Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
From the Air America affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, the Mike 92.1. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today as he enjoys the week-long Air America cruise. 866-303-2270. We have breaking news for you at this hour from the Senate chambers on Capitol Hill. Senate Democrats today, just moments ago, have yielded to the wishes of the President-elect Barack Obama and have allowed Senator Joe Lieberman, I believe his affiliation, party affiliation these days is the Liebermans for Lieberman Party, they've allowed Joe Lieberman to keep his committee chairmanship despite having backed Republican John McCain in a bitter battle for the White House. This was a closed-door meeting in which, after they came out, Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa told reporters that Democrats had stripped Lieberman of a subcommittee chairmanship. Slap on the wrist, really. There were fears that Lieberman, a former Democrat turned independent when he lost his primary for the Senate, might become a Republican if he lost his chairmanship for the Homeland Security Committee. This from Reuters or just moments ago. Democratic aides say Barack Obama urged Democrats to do what it takes to keep Lieberman, who represents Lieberman's, in the Senate conference where he routinely votes with the Democratic Party. So I guess the healing is on. Is this healing, or is Barack Obama surrounding himself with, Brutus comes to mind, for heaven's sakes. Where is Barack Obama going with this? Meeting with John McCain yesterday in what could only be described in the most uncomfortable I haven't seen John McCain look that uncomfortable since the last presidential debate. You know, when he... the winking and the fidgeting, and yet Barack Obama was laid back, cool as a cucumber. It was tough to watch. It was tough to watch. Like those embarrassing, funniest home videos that aren't necessarily funny. It's just difficult to watch. It was like watching The Office for me. It ain't easy sitting through that uncomfortable atmosphere. So what is this project of healing that is going on with the Obama administration? And whether or not progressives, Democrats, liberals, centrists, and even right-wing conservatives should get on board with this idea that the Barack Obama administration is going to heal all wounds. I mean, we're still going through the vetting process of Senator Clinton for a possible Secretary of State seat. This would be interesting because it has forced the Clintons to, well, basically open up their books, and it's gone back and forth with the story last night in Politico, and then the response from, quite quietly, I might add, from the Clinton campaign. Here's how it works. Former President Bill Clinton has the Clinton Foundation, which has raised millions and done so for good causes. He was also last week doing speaking engagements, not necessarily good causes, but hey, lucrative. What was it, $300,000 to sit and talk? Which is exactly what I'm making sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Senator Clinton is President-elect's first choice for Secretary of State at this point. But as the day started yesterday, you heard reports from the transition team complaining about the Clinton camp slowly responding to the vetting that needs to get done to put Senator Clinton in as the next Secretary of State of the United States. This may... I'm torn. The whole team of rivals cabinet suggests to me that Barack Obama is reaching for the stars. However, I think that reach might leave him vulnerable to people who have played politics as a death sport in the past. There's no fairness in politics. Senator Clinton has to show that her husband, a former president, and his many foreign financial engagements would not pose any conflict of interest. And there are some examples that have been given already. For example, what if the president continues to arrange donations for foreign countries at the same time that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, which has a nice ring to it, is asking them for diplomatic concessions? With the way the Clinton team has been arranged, is there any doubt that people would feel pressure from both sides? I think that's tough. The Clinton finances have been a sticking point, and according to one Democratic insider off the record, it has been a major point of sensitivity, is the quote, from day one. The former president has been in Kuwait City, the Netherlands, Rotterdam, in the Netherlands for the last week. And so he's been making like $500,000 just for opening his mouth. Wow, must be nice. I'm curious to get your feedback on the team of rivals cabinet that is that Barack Obama is building. Is this a politically savvy move? It's somewhat unprecedented. I think most people are going back to the cabinet of Abe Lincoln, and we all know that ended well. Mm. The other news, and this is sort of on the back burner, but if you've been following the net neutrality debate as I have, and if you're not familiar with it, it's about this basic, that there is a fight underway to try to privatize the Internet to make it a multi-tiered service so the rich get served faster and the poor will just have to wait for their porn. The net neutrality would protect the Internet so that we didn't create a multi-tier system in which the rich get to download while the poor are stuck surfing and waiting, waiting more than surfing. The Obama transition team, at the end of the week last week, and it didn't really get a lot of attention, but it's worth noting, named two longtime net neutrality advocates to head up the FCC review team. This is interesting because what we're seeing now is Kevin Werbach, former FCC staffer, spoken out on behalf of net neutrality, keeping our net available for all, is going to lead the Obama transition team's review of the FCC along with Susan Crawford, a professor of Michigan at the University of Michigan Law School. And Crawford's interesting because it's a completely different angle to the FCC than we've seen over the last 8 years, where the focus of the FCC has been not on the consolidation and conglomeration of our media information outlets, where we get our news from, our stories that we base our reality on. But rather, they've been more focused on Janet Jackson's nipple and maybe an F-bomb dropped here and there, but certainly not Joe Scarborough. I don't think the FCC has oversight over cable channels. Crawford, Susan Crawford, this woman who is, along with Kevin Werbach, going to lead up the FCC review team for the Obama transition, said that Internet access, her belief is that Internet access is utility, period. And therefore it should be shared, period. And therefore you cannot create two tiers of utility where you have heat when it is available for the poor, but heat all winter long for the rich. It does not work. And the same can be said about information as more and more information moves online. 866-303-2270. Let's go to Dallas, Texas, where Rich is standing by. Rich, you're on Air America Radio on the Tom Hartman Show.
Good morning, sir. Calling from the final resting place of George W. Bush.
What do you think?
Hopefully it will be a quiet resting place as well.
Hold on. Before you move on, you open the door, and I've got to walk through it. He will be the most interesting ex-president ever. We have no idea what he's going to do. Is he going to own an oil company and never find a drop of oil in Texas? Is he going to own a baseball team and trade the best slugger to come around in a generation off to the Chicago baseball team? What's George W. going to be as an ex-president?
Those of us who live here, and I'm a Red Sox fan myself, but those of us who live here and want to see the Texas Rangers at least compete are scared to death that he's going to want the team back.
You know what? He couldn't hurt anybody there except for Rangers fans, which is not bad collateral damage, all things considered, with him, so it might not be a bad idea. What's your thoughts on the team of rivals cabinet?
Well, let me tell you, the team of rivals cabinet doesn't worry me at all. I think Barack Obama is going to get the best and brightest. I think he'll be able to have competing opinions in the room. I'm not at all concerned that he's going to have, well, I mean, guys like Chuck Hagel and other, you know, Republicans that have been brought up don't scare me. It's that dumb Republicans scare me. Smart ones don't.
You know what I mean? You can apply that to all politicians, though. I mean, it's not like we've got a monopoly on the smarts over here. We just got a monopoly on the ideas for the people. That's all.
Very true. And then guys like David Gergen, who went into Clinton's White House and did an awful lot of good, can be, I mean, there's always something positive to be gained from the other side. But my question is this. Conciliatory Barack Obama, as far as building his team in this cabinet, is one thing. But are we going to let this war criminal, and that's, I consider George W. Bush a war criminal, I consider the oil companies to have been wartime profiteers, are we going to let these people off the hook in the name of conciliation?
Are you ready for the answer?
Yes.
Yes.
I know that's the answer, but tell me why I shouldn't be furious about it.
Well, that I don't have the answer for, Rich. I appreciate the call. But the incoming administration, according to the Associated Press yesterday, said they are unlikely to bring any criminal charges against government officials who may have authorized illegal interrogations, illegal wiretapping. In fact, we'll get to this a little later in the afternoon. The story out of the Obama campaign is to move forward and not look back. There will be no recriminations. And it may be a moot point at the end of the day, Rich, because George W. has got some pardoning to do on the way out of office, and it may be the last action he takes. And even 8 years ago, you may remember, President Clinton's pardoning was not necessarily above the board. Remember Mark Rich? What you might not remember is who his attorney was when he was pardoned. Mark Rich's attorney was none other than L. Scooter, or was it I. Scooter? Either way, Scooter Libby! Yeah, that guy who outed Valerie Plame. That was Mark Rich's lawyer. Interesting. No? 866-303-2270. It's the Tom Hartman Show. Lee Rayburn sitting in on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman Program.
But above all, I will never forget who this victory truly belongs to. It belongs to you.
Now more with Tom Hartman on the Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KPHX.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman at 21 minutes after the hour. Here's the story just out moments ago. In a closed-door meeting today, Senate Democrats voted 42-13 overwhelmingly to allow Senator Joe Lieberman, the independent from Connecticut, to keep his chairmanship of the Senate Homeland Security Committee despite his overwhelming and unfair attacks on Barack Obama, his Americanism, his patriotism, and whether or not he even can protect America in terms of the Homeland Security. Fascinating what an overwhelming vote it was in favor of Joe Lieberman, who has spurned the Democratic Party, speaking at the Republican National Convention earlier this year in St. Paul, Minnesota. The idea of a team of rivals is not just a theory anymore. It's a reality. But Barack Obama's first choice for Secretary of State, Senator Hillary Clinton, is dependent now on whether or not former President Bill Clinton will turn over his financial information. It is every indication from the Clinton camp is that that's exactly what is going to happen, and soon, which means that will pave the way for Secretary of State Clinton, who also challenged Barack Obama in the primaries. I don't know if no, I do know. Barack Obama's a bigger man than I am. I don't think I would have the guts to do assemble a team of rivals, especially knowing what they said about you, how they maligned your character, and your aptitude and ability to lead this country. I'm curious from you this morning whether or not you think this team of rivals could come back and bite Barack in the bum. Because and with all due respect to the Clintons and the best 8 years of my life under the Clinton administration from 92 to 2000, I know they're always campaigning, they're always politicking, and I think the 8 years in office that Clinton had to beat down to defend himself against the right wing is proof positive that they never stopped campaigning. So how does Senator Clinton campaign were she to be Secretary of State, and does that slight Barack Obama? How does the independent Senator Joe Lieberman run as an independent leading the Homeland Security Committee in the U.S. Senate? I don't know how this is going to play out. And I'll be honest with you, my reaction is kind of the excited anticipation I had leading up to the presidential election itself. I think if they're in no uncertain terms, in the very least, this has certainly kept us interested in what's going on Capitol Hill in what has otherwise been considered a lame duck session. 866-303-2270. Let's go to Lorenzo in Ohio. Lorenzo, you're on the Tom Hartman Show on Air America Radio.
Hey, how's it going, buddy?
Good.
I'll tell you exactly. First of all, I was a huge Barack supporter, maxed out contribution-wise, knocked on doors for him and everything. In order to get Hillary and Bill to campaign the way they did for him, this was a deal he made with her, the campaign in Ohio and Florida and in Pennsylvania the way she did. He made a side deal with her. And this Joe Lieberman thing, in my barbershop, we all just think they're showing Barack as he has no heart. He's a jellyfish. He let Lieberman walk all over him because he's scared he's going to become a Republican. So what? He needs to get a spine and stand up for himself.
Or Lorenzo, well, let me offer you an alternative to the barbershop wisdom, and I do not discount barbershop wisdom ever. But at the same time, this might be an instance where, you know, Joe Lieberman's so small and Barack Obama's such a big man that if Joe Lieberman walked all over Barack Obama, our president-elect wouldn't even feel it, wouldn't even touch him, just brush the dirt off his shoulder.
You can't have somebody that that talked about you the way he did, said you can't be a good leader, running Homeland Security. He contradicts everything that Barack stands for. So how can you have him represent your party? How can you have this guy on television saying the things he did and then have an aside chairman of the Homeland Security?
Specifically about Homeland Security, Lorenzo,
I'm disappointed.
Well, but hold out hope, man, because I do believe that it could be end up being where Barack Obama has such tremendous momentum, so much so that he doesn't have to do what George W. did 4 years ago and say, I've got political capital and I'm going to use it. No,
well,
he knows he's
right. But his first couple of moves have been terrible, I really pray that it gets better.
I'll tell you something just between you and me. I hope I'm right, too. Thank you for the call, Lorenzo. Let's go to Debbie in Portland. Debbie, good afternoon. You're on Air America Radio.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think we shouldn't underestimate Barack. I think he's going into Jesus mode.
Jesus mode?
Yeah.
Are you sure it's not the Antichrist mode? Because I hear both.
No, I think it's Jesus mode. He's trying to show these people what their religion should really look like.
And what should that religion really look like?
Forgiveness, kindness, caring, love.
They're real Christian values.
No fear.
Hey, and you know, maybe that epitomizes the moves he's made since becoming president-elect. He is fearless.
Exactly.
I would be a little worried to invite the Clinton family over for dinner just because I know what I'd get is a lot of campaigning over the dinner hour. A little indigestion, too.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think he's smarter than we're giving him credit for.
I think that's a great point, Debbie, that he is taking the high road here. And how can you criticize somebody for taking the high road and letting bygones be bygones and moving forward?
Exactly. And our religion has taught us not to do that.
Well, all religions teach
but a lot of fundamentalist religion has taught us not to follow what would Jesus do.
Well, he would. It's the golden rule. That much we know. Treat others the way you want to be treated. And is that not the example that Barack Obama is setting as our president-elect? Ooh, that's kind of exciting. Thank you for the call, Debbie. I appreciate it. Sorry to cut you off there. I really think that we are on the verge of, a changing politic on Capitol Hill. Coming up next, Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, joins us. We'll ask him about the cabinet of rivals, the team of rivals that are assembling. He also has an amazing story about the Canadian military coming to the United States. What? You gotta be kidding me. I can't wait to talk about it. And we will continue to address the big three meeting on Capitol Hill today to take their lumps. Also today, your rights and where they stand. Our guest when we continue. Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, online at progressive.org. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today at 866-303-2270. You're listening to Air America Radio.
This is Lee Rayburn, guest hosting on the Tom Hartman Program.
More than two centuries later, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people has not perished from the earth. This is your victory.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio, joining me in the studio. The studios of the Air America affiliate in Madison, Wisconsin, the Mike 92.1, is the editor of the Progressive Magazine, celebrating 100 years online at progressive.org. Well, they haven't been online for 100 years, but...
No, we got on pretty quick.
Matt Rothschild joining us. Good afternoon, Matt. And I want to start by jumping right into the deepest pool right now, and that has to do with the deepest pool I've got going on today are our rights and where we stand with our rights. As you detail on progressive.org today, hey, this Vigilant Shield is coming to an end today.
Yeah, there was this exercise that the U.S. military, including NORTHCOM, which came into being in October 2002, this is the wing of the Pentagon that's supposed to patrol the United States.
I thought
that was illegal. Anyway, NORTHCOM is involved in this exercise called Vigilant Shield with the Canadian military, and it's a 7-day exercise that ends today. It's supposed to, and now I'm quoting from the press release about it, include scenarios to achieve exercise objectives within the maritime, aerospace, ballistic missile defense, cyber, consequence management, strategic communications, I love that, and counterterrorism domains. So these are war games about what would happen here in the United States in the event of an emergency.
Doesn't Mexico feel left out?
They maybe they're invited. I don't know.
But this ends today, the Vigilant Shield.
Yeah.
But as you detailed in your progressive commentary online yesterday, Matt, there is a new agreement that the U.S. government has signed with Canada to allow, am I mistaken, allow Canadian troops into the United States under emergency circumstances?
Yeah, and U.S. troops into Canada. While I was looking at Vigilant Shield at the NORTHCOM website, I came across this agreement called Canada Command and U.S. Northern Command, U.S.-Canada Civil Assistance Plan, or CAP. I didn't know anything about it. It was released in February. Evidently, it made a bit of a stir up in Canada. As you can well imagine, they're not very comfortable with the idea of U.S. troops going into Canada. That's a long-time obsession up there. But neither, I don't
John
think...
John Candy made a movie about it, even. Or was it Michael Moore?
John Candy was in it. I don't think we should be too excited either about the possibility of the Canadian military coming across the border in some kind of an emergency. And so I looked at this Canada Command and U.S. Northern Command document, and it's quite extraordinary. I mean, it talks about some benign things like helping out with floods, forest fires, hurricanes, earthquakes, but also effects of a terrorist attack. And then it says, you know, we don't expect to encounter opposing forces when we're there, but look out, they could be there, and so they can use force. The Canadian military in the United States or the U.S. military in Canada.
Wait, so in the event of an emergency, whether it's a wildfire or a terrorist attack, then the Canadian military can come into the United States borders and can use force?
Well, there's some approval ladders they have to climb. They've got to get the approval of the Canadians and the U.S. But if there's mutual agreement, yeah, Canadian troops can be in the U.S., U.S. troops can be in Canada.
And I find this fascinating with your uncovering of the presidential directive from last year where the president detailed what would happen in the event of martial law, and it ended up where the vice president's office had actually more power than Congress itself.
Yeah, well, this is Directive 51 that was May 2007. You can find that at whitehouse.gov, the whole executive order, and that's where Bush basically says, in times of emergency, and this isn't just natural disasters or even terrorist attacks, it's also dire economic circumstances. Wow, that's
Just check my watch and count down from 3, 2, 1, and I think we're about there now.
So in that executive order 51, Bush gives to himself the power to protect our Constitution, which is a laugh, given what he's done to our Constitution, and above all else, just run the entire government. Maybe asking Congress and the judicial branch for some input, but basically the president runs the show in an emergency, and the president decides when there's an emergency.
Judge, jury, and executioner, executive, legislative, and judicial.
What I don't understand, Lee, is where is Congress on this? Why isn't Congress holding hearings on what's going to happen if we have a president who is declaring a national emergency or martial law? This isn't a hypothetical. Representative Brad Sherman of California, when Paulson was ramming through this bailout bill, said on the floor of the House that he was told that if we don't accept this, if we don't vote for this, there might be martial law in a matter of days.
Did he ever explain what he meant when spoke on the record on the House floor?
I called his office, talked to his press person. They weren't, you know, they don't want the story to keep going around, so they were backpedaling feverishly. But, you know, how often do you hear an elected official talk about martial law? Now, it's not the first time I've heard those phrases from former high officials in the Bush administration. For instance, Tommy Franks, who led the invasion of Iraq, said, if we're attacked again by terrorists with weapons of mass destruction, we're going to have to suspend the Constitution. And then Wayne Downing, who was Condoleezza Rice's deputy at the NSC, said the very same thing.
In our innocuous color-coded security threat level thing that we've developed, that rainbow, that panoply of colors, isn't red a martial law event?
I don't know. I mean, that's what I want to know. You know, what would it look like? And who's to stop the president?
You had detailed in a story a couple months ago about the privatization of a militia, martial law force, this InfraGuard that was being developed, that it could be as simple as an oil refinery explosion. It could be as simple as, from the speculation that we've heard, it could be anything, including what Congressman Sherman said on the House floor, an economic collapse that could lead to a martial law. Are we fast-forwarding January 20th to our own peril?
Well, I'm a poker player, and I always put odds on everything, and the odds of martial law in the United States have got to be under 1%, but I used to think they were much lower than that. I mean, you know, I've seen 1% come true at the card table. So,
well, we're talking about the Cheney's 1% doctrine, for heaven's sake. So, Matt, 1% means 100% in the Cheney betting pool.
Yeah, and so why isn't Congress, preparing for that? I mean, that's the Cheney doctrine. You know, if something's got a 1% chance, we've got to prepare for it.
They're not even talking about it, though.
You know, this is what needs to be done. I mean, certainly if we get to the Obama administration, which I think we will, I mean, there should be, and I know Russ Feingold, the senator from Wisconsin, wants this to happen, a whole airing out of all the civil liberties infringements that have occurred under the Bush administration and rolling those back one after another.
President-elect Barack Obama walks into the White House January 20th, 2009, with more executive power than any president maybe since Ford. With what Nixon did with the White House. Is this something that you have any indication as to whether or not Barack Obama may overturn as the president or just ride with? I mean, once you're given powers, it's not like you want to take those powers away if they're yours.
Yeah, it's kind of the toll booth theory. You know, they put up the toll booth, they don't take the toll booth down. I mean, I don't think, first of all, let's give Obama credit. He did say that he would, after assuming power, one of the first things he'd do would ask his attorney general to look over all the executive orders that President Bush put through and repeal those that he thinks are unconstitutional or an infringement on our rights. However, you know, is Obama going to go ahead and stop doing these signing statements? Is he going to, you know, change his mind on FISA? He voted for FISA, for God's sakes.
Is he going to redirect the Presidential Directive 51, which recreates the government in the event of martial law?
Yeah, these are the things we need to look at. These are the things that we as civil libertarians need to pressure Obama on. I know the ACLU has been very active in getting a campaign to do so, and I encourage listeners to go to ACLU.org and join that effort. It's a crucial effort.
Matt Rothschild, our guest, editor of the Progressive Magazine, online at progressive.org. And as we move closer to January 20th, we're looking at possibly 4 million people showing up at the inaugural. It would be four times more than anybody else who has ever come to see the swearing-in of a new president. And yet, at the same time, we're hearing a slew of stories about gun purchases going up. We're hearing a slew of stories of hundreds of crimes, hate crimes being committed. This is according to the Southern Poverty Law Center in the aftermath of the Obama election. We're seeing a rise in the racism that some had hoped we could get over in this presidential election. It creates a sort of unstable climate for January 20th, 2009, Matt.
It does, and one of the great things about Election Day was the realization, at least a part of the American dream, that we can get past racism enough to elect a black president.
So but we couldn't get even over homophobia on
November
4th.
No, we still have a ways to go in this country. That's the thing. You know, America is not America yet. You know, Langston Hughes has that great poem, "Let America Be America Again, Let It Be the Dream. It used to be America, has never been America to me." And so we got to make America America. That's make it live up to the dream, and we shouldn't be nostalgic that it was sometime prior, because it's never been.
It's interesting, Matt Rothschild, that over the last 8 years, one of the things I feel most powerless about is to regain my own personal civil liberties and my own rights. It's rather ironic that they're mine, they're afforded to me with the fabric of our government and the U.S. Constitution and my Bill of Rights, and yet I don't know what action, if we were to begin to take action to restore our rights under an Obama administration, if we were to begin to take action to look at what would happen in the event of martial law and whether or not that's good for the country as opposed for an executive who is empowering himself, how do we even empower ourselves to get involved in this process?
Well, I think we need to help Senator Feingold out. He's trying to repeal parts of the Patriot Act, for instance, that have taken some of our rights out. Even in the revised Patriot Act, which was supposed to make it better, it actually made it worse in one respect, in that the Secret Service can designate an event where the president or vice president is supposed to attend, designate that whole thing as a national security event. And if you're not obeying what the Secret Service says, if you don't go to that free speech zone, which should be anathema, and the whole country is supposed to be a free speech zone, if you don't go there, the Secret Service can put you in prison for a year. And if there's violence at that event that you didn't cause, you can be in for 10 years. We got to get that out of the revised Patriot Act.
Oh, Matt, what goes on behind the scenes, what doesn't make the front page of the news, what the 22 minutes of national news every evening don't tell us, is a startling story of what still needs to be discussed. We should be a part of this debate, after all. It is our rights. It is our homeland security that is at stake here.
And there are some people in Congress who are pushing this. Pat Leahy is very good on civil liberties, so I would look to him to push things. I mean, what I worry about is Obama's going to get in and he's going to say, or his advisors, Rahm Emanuel, is the most centrist guy on earth, is going to say, look, we can't be pushing, you know, to give people more civil liberties. What if we're attacked again? And the right wing's going to say, look, you did that, therefore you were attacked, and we can't protect against that for the next election. I hope that kind of defeatist mentality doesn't begin on day one.
We are hearing some leaks from the Obama transition team. One thing that they have been absolutely tight-lipped about without any comment off the record that I've seen, maybe you have, is whether or not they will repeal the warrantless domestic wiretap program that was put in place by George W. Bush and was planned prior to September 11th, 2001.
I don't think they're going to repeal it.
I didn't think so either.
I mean, Obama voted for the FISA bill, which basically blessed the Bush illegal acts. I mean, Bush should be impeached because he was illegally spying.
That's
on
the other thing.
He admitted that he had done it illegally. He admitted that, you know, there is this law on the books called FISA that says the exclusive means by spying on, for spying on U.S. citizens is first to get a warrant from the FISA court. And he said, guess what? I'm not going to the FISA court.
But they've also said that the Obama transition team has leaked that they will not be looking to prosecute anybody in the Bush administration, and that may pave the way for George W. to feel safe not to pardon anybody on his way out of office.
Oh, I'm expecting a lot of pardons. But, you know, maybe the only hope is, you know, when Cheney or Rumsfeld, you know, travel abroad, that some Spanish judge or prosecutor will try to nab him. It would take a lot of cojones, because, you know, then you'll have the full power of the U.S. government arrayed against you. And I don't think...
And maybe the Canadian military, too.
I mean, yeah.
Matt Rothschild.
They may help us.
Matt Rothschild, our guest. He's the editor of the Progressive Magazine, celebrating its 100th year online at progressive.org. Our conversation with Matt continues. You can join in at 866-303-2270. We'll also take a look at the former Goldman Sachs executive, Hank Paulson, and what he's up to with our hundreds of billions of dollars. I saw one estimate that says our economic bailout at this point has been pushed to over $4 trillion. We could have bought a couple more unnecessary wars for that money.
Can't have health care, though.
No, that would be especially not for the automakers. Our conversation with Matt Rothschild continues next. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. It's 47 minutes after the hour. And take a look at your own rights. See where they stand. And see what kind of lack of debate we've seen so far on Capitol Hill about what our rights will be when we continue under an Obama administration. Interesting that it hasn't been talked about, not much, not yet. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
You're listening to guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman.
The road ahead will be long, but America, I have never been more hopeful than I am tonight that we will get there. I promise you, we as a people will get there.
Back to the Tom Hartman Program, live on the Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KPHX.
52 minutes after the hour, Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Happy to have you along for the ride. Joining me in the Air America affiliate studio at the Mike 92.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, online at progressive.org, Matt Rothschild. And Matt, before we move on to Hank Paulson and the Goldman Sachs bailout, I want to take a quick call about what we've been talking about earlier with the Canadian military coming to the U.S. if we need them. Matthew in San Diego, California, you're on Air America Radio with Matt Rothschild from the Progressive.
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify what the congressman from California was talking about was in reference to congressional martial law as opposed to civil martial law. We all know civil martial law to be when the army polices civilian streets.
What's congressional martial law?
That is when the Speaker of the House wants to force Congress to vote on something without giving them ample time to read it. So Nancy Pelosi was threatening to force this bill onto the floor for a vote without giving them the time to read it, which essentially pretty much happened because it's such a...
Why didn't they use martial law, congressional martial law, for the Patriot Act then, Matthew? Because Lord knows they didn't read that.
I don't know. I don't know about the time and all that. I can't go into... I don't know about that.
Well, I appreciate the call, Matthew.
You're
welcome. And Matt Rothschild, what about congressional martial law? First I ever heard of it.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I think that's a story after the story that maybe Brad Sherman, the representative from California, was issuing when he said, you know, you're being a little impolitic to get this thing public about martial law. Don't scare the kids. And so they invented this thing about martial law in the House of Representatives. It was quite clear from his comments. Anyone can see his comments by Googling Representative Brad Sherman and martial law and bailout, and you can see him on the House floor.
Well, and Matt, I would think that I just think that the cover up here is part of the reason we're not having the debate. That any time it comes up, people are quick to quash it so that we can't even discuss whether or not or what our rights may or may not be in the event of the next dire emergency in the United States.
Yeah, there's plenty of stuff out, not just Representative Sherman's comments, but
no.
Tommy Franks, Wayne Downing. All you got to do is look at Executive Order 51, Presidential Directive, National Security Directive 51, and you've got to study that and say, wow, these guys are planning for something. All the ducks are in a row. Why isn't any one of our elected officials worried enough about this to hold a hearing? Now, the Democrats have controlled Congress. They control it even more. Let's get this out in the open. That's what we should do in a democracy.
Let's talk about it. Matt Rothschild, changing gears here and looking at the big three meeting on Capitol Hill today. Our three American automobile manufacturers going to Capitol Hill today to ask for a bailout. Hank Paulson has already spent about half of the $700 billion. It was $840 billion price tag. I don't know if we paid taxes on that or... Oh, no, right. There were sweeteners. It used to be pork barrel projects. Now they're sweeteners. It looks like he spent about half of it. We don't know where it's gone or to whom, but we know this much. The Treasury securities that it was supposed to buy have not been purchased.
Yeah, wasn't that great? You got to ram this through. We gave a three-page plan, you got to accept it, or the stock market's going to go down 2,000 points. Well, guess what? The stock market did go down 2,000 points since that went through. And then he said his great plan for solving the financial crisis, oops, I'm going to do something else. I mean, this was the most incompetent and arrogant act by a U.S. Treasury Secretary that I can remember. And there he is today testifying this morning before Congress. I'm very proud of the decisive actions I've taken. Oh, give me a break, man. What's there to be proud of? He lavished $250 billion on these banks, our money on these banks that caused the problem in the first place. He didn't get anything from these banks who were over a barrel, who were about to go bankrupt. And all he got was some concession on executive pay. He didn't get anything about how to run the banks. He didn't insist that the banks give lending to people who need it, to businesses who need it.
And how many homes facing foreclosure did it help?
It didn't help any. He's doing nothing about helping people who are about to lose their
homes. We have farms in our backyard here, Matt, that are facing foreclosure, many of them that I know of. And we're watching the family farmer, non-corporate agriculture really die in this economic crisis. And it's a story that is yet to be told, even though it's the food we put on our plate every night.
Vets, too, are being foreclosed on. There's no moratorium on foreclosures. We need that. There's no freeze on subprime mortgage rates. We need that. Paulson's against all of it.
Well, what does that leave us with then? Just a free ticket. I mean, really, literally, privatizing profit while socializing loss.
Yeah, I mean, this is a case.
Marx must be spinning in his grave.
I mean, Marx would say nationalize the banks. Maybe we should discuss that sometime.
There's a debate worth having. Matt Rothschild, it's always a pleasure to have you in the studio with us. Thank you very much. Make sure you check out the Progressive Magazine. Make sure you check it out online. Matt's got a half-hour radio show. Boy, you do it all. And the McCarthy Watch as well. We've still got to go to January 20th, and I'm guessing the McCarthy Watch won't end then either, will it, Matt?
I'm hoping so. I need a break, man.
Progressive.org, the website. Matt Rothschild, editor of Progressive, our guest. My name's Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Our conversation continues in the next hour right here on Air America Radio.
This is guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program, live and exclusively on the Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KPHX.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio at 866-303-2270. Let me ask you, how is your economy? News in the last hour that Senator Joe Lieberman, the senator of Lieberman's, has decided to or has been able to keep his chairmanship of the Senate Homeland Security Committee on an overwhelming vote and a closed-door vote of Senate Democrats. It looks like Senator Lieberman is back in the fray and making nice again with the Democratic Party. Meanwhile, the moves continue to pave the way for the vetting process of former President Bill Clinton to make Senator Hillary Clinton our next Secretary of State. But before we take calls on that at 866-303-2270, I just want to bring up a couple of issues about your economy. Not the economy, I mean your pocketbook, your wallet, your purse. You know that what happens on Capitol Hill, what happens in your state house, what happens at your municipal governments, all those issues that happen every day that get glossed over or get scant attention on the TV news, you know, those are what directly affect your pocketbook and what's inside it every day. Not only what's inside it, but who can look in it. And yesterday we wrapped up the show with our war on Christmas. I was sitting in for Tom Hartman and my idea of creating this Christmas carol. If they really want a war on Christmas, I'll give them one because I'm pissed about the Proposition Hate measure. I'm pissed that they use God to hate the same things they hate. And, you know, brother, if God hates the same things you hate, you're praying to yourself. Or, worse yet, if God hates at all, I would suggest you might be praying in the wrong direction. Just a thought. Just a thought. Nevertheless, the focus on the family started their war on Christmas on Easter this year, a little bit early for the shopping season. We're not even at Thanksgiving yet, but never mind that. For Focus on the Family, they started their holiday war on Easter. And they have a website. You can go to Focus on the Family right now and find out Christmas-friendly stores, Christmas-indifferent stores, or anti-Christmas stores. They've got lists there. And you're a Christmas-friendly store if you only ever say Merry Christmas and you make sure no Jews or Muslims, or atheists for that matter, or agnostics ever show up on your doorstep. Or you could use Christmas sometimes. This would be the Christmas negligent or the middle of the road group. You can say Christmas sometimes, but other times you say Happy Holidays, and that is just a slap in the face to Christmas. And then you have the Christmas unfriendly stores, which will not say Christmas under no circumstances. And that's where I'm doing my holiday shopping this year. Of course, my Christmas carol idea, all I've come up with so far is the chorus, "Let's kick the Christ out of Christmas," and the fact that it needs jingle bells in there somewhere. Otherwise, it's not a carol. Well, after we got done with the show yesterday, I found out that Focus on the Family has not focused on the family very well. They are announcing that 202 jobs will be cut company-wide at Focus on the Family. That is more than 20% of the workforce. You know who else recently laid off 20% of the workforce but got a lot more attention for it? Citibank just recently laid off or plans to lay off 20% of the workforce. You know, with family values like that, we could almost rename Citibank Focus on the Family. Or maybe we could rename Focus on the Family Hate Bank. They're announcing major layoffs in their Colorado Springs ministry and media empire. Meanwhile, their cash contributions to Proposition Hate was estimated at somewhere around $600,000. Those cash contributions, roughly the equivalent of the 20 jobs that they could have kept, but instead they decided to spend it because, you know, here's what Newt Gingrich had to say with Bill O'Reilly the other day. I thought this was funny.
Look, I think there is a gay and secular fascism in this country that wants to impose its will on the rest of us, is prepared to use violence, to use harassment. I think it is prepared to use the government if it can get control of it. I think that it is a very dangerous threat to anybody who believes in traditional religion.
Mm-hmm. Traditional marriage, for that matter. You know, traditional marriage in traditional religion was like Solomon. Remember Solomon? No, of course, a little before your time and mine. He had hundreds of wives. Hundreds of wives. Oh, the tradition of marriage has been the same for thousands of years. Really? Well, then you are a couple wives short, sir. Remember the tradition of marriage where you could still rape your wife and it wasn't rape? Remember the tradition of marriage when your wife was your property and you owned her? Yeah, that tradition of marriage, it's just been unchanged for thousands of years, dating all the way back to when Solomon had only hundreds of wives. So, and by the way, Focus on the Family's had job cuts for the last 3 years, evidently, according to Huffington Post. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. This is going to be, could be, the proverbial Christmas without a Santa Claus or the Hanukkah without a dreidel. We are on the verge of something worse than we could have expected. CNBC has crunched the numbers, actually, and have come up with a running tally of how much we've spent on this ongoing economic bailout, the socialization of loss while privatizing profit. The number they came up with, and you're going to need to sit down for this because I can't wrap my head around it. It's a lot of dough. $4.25 trillion. That is $4,250,500,000,000. And this is comprised of budgeted dollars, actual spending, guarantees, loans, and other market mechanisms used by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and our government. 68% of this money falls under the umbrella of the Federal Reserve, according to CNBC. Another 16% is under the recently passed Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, which is the blank check that was given to Hank Paulson, which is now being used to... And we don't know how it's being used. Let me be honest. We have no idea, and it's raised some ire and created some strange political bedfellows, I must say. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent, a socialist, for heaven's sakes, originally voted against the socialization of loss Wall Street bailout program and is now asking for an accounting of the $350 billion that Hank Paulson has already spent of our $700 billion emergency bailout. Where did it go? Nobody knows. The one thing we do know is the money was, we were told, to be used to finance Treasury Department purchases of mortgage-backed securities that were in danger of amounting to nothing. It would have cost banks. It would have cost jobs. However, that's what we were told. To date, no such Treasury Department purchases have been made. None. The administration, and this is what Sanders said, Senator Sanders, the administration's plans as to how the money should be spent appear to be changing on a daily basis, and meanwhile, they're operating in secrecy, ignoring the oversight provisions of the legislation, and, with dubious legality, are changing long-established rules by providing huge tax breaks for the banking industry. But that's just some independent socialist from beautiful, wonderful, perfect, healthiest city, with the healthiest city in the country. How about Vermont? Come on! That it was until U.S. Senator James Inhofe from Oklahoma said that Congress has not been told the truth about the bailout of the nation's financial system, and Congress needs to take back what's left of the $700 billion blank check given to Hank Paulson, the former chair of Goldman Sachs. Here's what James Inhofe had to say, and it's funny because it sounds so similar to what that socialist Bernie Sanders had to say. It is most outrageous that the American people don't know that Congress doesn't know how much money Hank Paulson has given away to anyone. It could be to his friends, and it could be to anyone else. We don't know. There's no way of knowing. I get the sense that Senator Inhofe just does not know. But he's along with Bernie Sanders, that damn socialist. But they're not alone. Now, Republican Senator from Iowa, Chuck Grassley, has entered into the fray. He's seeking an investigation into potential conflicts of interest among former Goldman Sachs executives serving at the U.S. Treasury right now and whether or not they exceeded their authority by evidently changing the tax code without any approval by Congress. That does sound dubiously legal. Senator Grassley, the most senior Republican of the Senate Finance Committee at this point, has now asked the Inspector General of our Treasury to investigate the quote-unquote independence of several Treasury officials who formerly were employed at Goldman Sachs and now serve as advisors under the former chief executive of Goldman Sachs himself, our current Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson. Does anybody else think this doesn't pass the smell test besides Senators Inhofe, Grassley, and Sanders? Anybody else wonder why, if the CNBC account of how much we've bailed out, totaling $4.25 trillion, why we can't find $25 billion for an industry in the United States that is responsible for 1 in 10 jobs, that is responsible for 10% of our GDP? The chiefs of the big three are meeting up on Capitol Hill today to speak to Congress and ask them for that $25 billion. Heck, we've already doled out $4.25 trillion. I can't even wrap my head around that. That's so much money. But the chairs and CEOs of General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler are testifying to the Senate Banking Committee today. Any news breaks on that regard while we're on the air, we will bring it to you here. It looks like now a long shot that our American auto manufacturers are going to get bailed out. And if they don't, they run the risk of having to file for bankruptcy. And that's not a risk, mind you, to the CEOs. And that's not a risk to the chairman. The real risk there lies with the people who worked for General Motors, Chrysler, or Ford their entire lives, were under the agreement that they would be protected with some sort of retirement and pension and health care. The real risk here is if our auto manufacturers are forced to go into bankruptcy and restructure their company, that the union contracts that have been ratified will be lost, that the pension promise to retirees will be gone forever, and that the health care that increases the cost of every American-made automobile by an estimated $1,500 will be wiped out. Well, sure, that might make General Motors competitive again, but who the hell in this country would be able to afford a car, considering 1 in 10 jobs is dependent on our auto industry, considering 10% of our GDP is the responsibility of our auto industry? $4.25 trillion, and we can't find $25 billion to make sure that people who work their entire lives for the big three can live out their days peacefully without having to worry where their next meal, their next pharmaceutical, their next filling up the gas tank is going to come from? Seriously. 866-303-2270. Your calls are next. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Lee Rayburn filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
And while the Democratic Party has won a great victory tonight, we do so with a measure of humility and determination to heal the divides that have held back our progress.
It's 22 minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio, taking your calls at 866-303-2270. And whether it's the economy or the cabinet of rivals, there's certainly enough on the plate today to take a look at what's going on. And what your take is on it. We deserve some debate on these issues, and it's not like we're powerless to prevent it. I think in many degrees, I think what Barack Obama has shown all of us is that we actually have a role to play. Let's start with Corelli in Dallas. Corelli, you're on Air America Radio.
Hello, Lee. First of all, I just wanted to say what a conversation you had with Matt Rothschild. It's very informative.
Thank you.
And, you know, basically in keeping my ears to the events on the world stage scene, and particularly in our nation, America, what I was saying, even, and I salute our new commander-in-chief, Barack Obama, and his victory for president, what I was thinking was when yesterday meeting with John McCain and Barack Obama, I don't know, it seems to me it was quite unnerving.
Just, you think so?
Yeah, and I'm trying to wonder who's advising him on making these kind of, you know, moves already. And as far as Lieberman is concerned, I mean, I think Lieberman slandered him and defamed him and maligned his character and his family just as much as McCain did.
I agree with that. But the thing about President-elect Obama is that he didn't say, you know what, you beat the crap out of me during the election, and I'm going to hold that against you for my entire 8 years in office.
Yeah.
What he said was, you know what, you can't touch me.
He's a very gracious man, and I really commend him for that.
I can't remember a president in my lifetime that has been this cool. I thought Bill Clinton was cool until I met Barack Obama.
Well, that was one of the things that I voted for him for, because I voted for him as a man that had his house in order, mm-hmm. and as a man who had wisdom.
Well, and I think if you go by that, the best indication about a candidate as to how they're governed is to how they campaign. You know, Barack Obama faced the fire for 2 straight years. He was criticized and he was challenged by Senator Clinton. He was criticized and he was challenged by Senator McCain. He was criticized and he was challenged by Senator Lieberman. And yet he continued to keep his cool for 2 straight years. I have no doubt that in the case or in the event or the the unthinkable, that he's not going to sit around and read My Pet Goat for 7 minutes before taking action.
Yeah, and I think as American people, all colors, we all went into that snake pit with him for this change that we so desperately want and need. Whether it's too late for it or whether we can hang on to it, I have some questions about it. The Clinton vetting, of course, I looked at, you know, Clinton, you know, when he's got some pep in his step, when he's mm-hmm. making comments. Well, the comment that he made as far as, you know, turning over, you know, he didn't exactly say that, but he said his wife would make a great Secretary
yep.
of State, but you should have seen his facial expressions. It's clear that he has some resentment there for even doing that.
I think it was just gas pain, Corelli. And seriously, you bring up a good point about the change we can believe in, because I think maybe part of this caustic environment on Capitol Hill that we had seen Bill Clinton ride into town on and say he's going to change and then be pretty much impeached for it, and that George W. Bush say he was going to change and then use it as a chip against Democrats, maybe this is part of the change we can believe in, that there is not going to be a red states and blue states, just like there's not going to be Republican senators and Democratic senators, that there's going to be U.S. senators, U.S. congressmen, and a U.S. president for the first time, maybe in my lifetime.
Well, I have great hope for it, but this is what I want to say with what you and Matt were talking about. You were saying this executive powers, and he was talking about the Constitution and national security, that Barack Obama would be the first president to go into the office with more power than just about any president. I had gotten some information that I consider a pretty reliable source on this one world government financial global system.
We're short on time here, Corelli, but I've heard the one world government idea.
Do you think that he's going to usher that in from the Bush administration, or do you think he's going to overturn that?
Well, I do not think he has said we're all. I mean, I think he is American through and through. I think he is the epitome of what being American means. I appreciate the call, Corelli. I've heard the one world government thing. I do not buy it. We are proud Americans, each and every one of us, and maybe no more so than President-elect Barack Obama, because where else in America, which is what the entire world was saying the morning of November 5th. And as well, in the same vein, I think that Barack Obama represents the antithesis of George W. Bush, that George W. Bush was somebody who really was born to be president, if you look at his family lines. Barack Obama was born on food stamps in a mixed-race family in the middle of America, and that has created the ultimate American story, not rags to riches, but really, literally, rags to president. Not necessarily rich, unless, well, vote rich, electoral vote rich. But no, he is, I think I still saw his used car the other day. It was on Huffington Post. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. You're listening to Air America Radio.
This is Lee Rayburn, guest hosting on the Tom Hartman Program.
I may not have won your vote tonight, but I hear your voice. I need your help. And I will be your president, too.
Now more with Tom Hartman on the Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KPHX.
My name is Lee Rayburn, and I'm sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Thank you for having me here on Air America Radio. My next guest is the executive director of Wellstone Action. You'll find out more online at wellstone.org. Please welcome to the show, Jeff Blodgett. Good afternoon, Jeff.
Thank you for having me on.
Are you kidding me? Thank you for Wellstone Action. I got to tell you, I took a Camp Wellstone a couple of years ago now, and here's the reason I asked you to join me today, Jeff, is because in the momentum in the aftermath of the momentum of the grassroots, unprecedented grassroots campaign run on a national level by Barack Obama, there is a huge amount of sentiment among the left and among progressives of okay, what do we do now?
Yeah.
And the one thing that I kept thinking of was, this is a perfect time for the likes of Wellstone Action to step in and make us all, each and every one of us, community organizers.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. Exactly. I mean, there's a Election Day was just the start, and there is so much to do on two fronts, I think. The first is there's a whole set of people who got involved in this campaign who should now think about running for office themselves.
Yeah.
You know, offices at all level, from school board on up. And so some people have to think of themselves now as candidates, leaders stepping forward. And then another set of people who help those candidates win, because you can't do it alone when you're a candidate. You always need a circle of skilled people to run your campaign. So now we need more candidates and good campaign workers to help those candidates win. That's the one hand. And on the second thing, we actually now have to push really hard to get the change we want to see happen on a set of issues. And so that means finding an organization on an issue that you believe in and using your skills there. And all along the way, we need to keep helping people get better, better at being organizers, better at being candidates, better at campaign workers. And that's what we're interested in doing, and helping train people to do all that work.
Jeff, you were the campaign manager for the late Senator Paul Wellstone from Minnesota from 1989 to 2002. What was it about working with Senator Wellstone that he imparted to you and everybody at Wellstone Action that allowed folks to continue to organize even after his passing?
Well, a couple of things. One, he was also always a teacher. That's what he did most of his career before he ran for office. And he was a community organizer. And so in all those capacities, his view was that this is about us, and this is about us taking our country back. And he was very, very intentional about helping people step forward and do the work themselves. And so, again, I think for this campaign that we just saw happen, all the hundreds of thousands of people who got involved when people did that for Paul Wellstone, again, it was just the start. People stayed involved. Many people ran for office off of his campaign. Many people decided to do careers in politics and public life. And so
Jeff, that's what
I hope we see.
I think I can speak on behalf of Al Franken that there would not be a senatorial campaign of Al Franken's, which could likely win Minnesota still, if there was not the Senator Paul Wellstone.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, you know, Al was one person who was inspired to step forward himself when we lost Paul Wellstone, and we've had a lot of examples of that around the country. Just, you know, at Wellstone Action, we run a candidate training program, and 103 of those candidates that went through our training won.
What?
This last
103?
103, yep.
Jeff?
And so...
You've earned a vacation, man.
Well, and that's on top of others who have won in the past couple of cycles as well. So I think what we're seeing is not just one, you know, new president in the White House, which is so great to see for this country, but we're seeing a new wave of leadership, a new wave of people stepping forward to make democracy work for them and for the country. And it's going to mean, I think, many new and different and interesting faces in offices all up and down the ladder.
Well, and what it's been traditionally about over the last decade or two, Jeff, is that if you had the money, you could run for office. But what Wellstone Action has made clear is if you have the right message, if you have the right organizing tools, if you have the right ideas, it's that simple. You can run for office.
That's right, although we don't minimize the importance of raising money. Look at the Obama campaign.
Yes.
I mean, they raised the resources they needed to win, because even if you run a grassroots campaign, it takes an army to move an army, and you have to invest in field staff and offices, and that takes money. So we don't minimize the money, but you don't have to be you know, personally wealthy to do this. That's
you don't have to be Mitt Romney in order to run for office.
No, you shouldn't have to be in this country, and I think we're getting to a point where we don't have to be. If you can use all the tools at your disposal as a good candidate, one who has a good message and is authentic, and then you run the best campaign you can, technically speaking, that's how you win.
Well, and having attended a Camp Wellstone a couple of years ago, Jeff Blodgett, our guest, executive director of Wellstone Action online at wellstone.org, you know, I didn't know how much I didn't know until I went to Camp Wellstone.
Well, it's not rocket science, these campaigns, but there is a science to it.
Yeah.
And so often we go into these things with the best intentions, but not very good planning or strategy. And so you want to think through your campaign at the beginning. And here's the thing to remember, you know, winning elections, you don't need every vote. You need 50% plus one vote. So think carefully about who it is you need to get to win. Because elections are about winning so that you can, and for good people, so that you can put good people in office so that they can govern effectively. And so you have to be disciplined and smart and strategic, as well as being someone with a good message and the right viewpoint.
And how does Wellstone Action empower people to get that done?
Well, so we run a training called Camp Wellstone. That is a 3-day training. I think you went through that. And it's we run it in three tracks, one track for candidates, one track for campaign workers, and a third track for citizen activists, people who are more interested in working on issues than they are working on campaigns. it takes all three sets of people to do what we need to do to make the change. It takes leaders who will run as candidates. It takes good campaign workers so we run effective campaigns. And then people who are pushing the issues and helping hold those people who are elected accountable. So it's all three fronts. And in each one of these, there's a set of skills. Everything from how you craft a message to how you go and talk to people, how you organize a volunteer organization, how do you target effectively so that you're talking to the right people, how do you plan, all those kinds of things are just skills that you can learn that make you better. And we, in the past, in we meaning the progressive movement, I think have been sort of lacking, falling behind on the skill set. We're now in a position to sort of make huge strides forward. And a lot of people learned some great stuff on the Obama campaign. And so now let's take that to the next level.
What was your reaction to the Obama campaign, the candidacy itself, and the grassroots effort that arose from this candidate?
That's right. I mean, you know, the thing about the Obama campaign, it's what I saw in Wellstone as well, is that it first starts with the candidate, and a candidate who can inspire people and who is authentic and connects to people so that there's this deep excitement about the candidate that's really broad. And so there was this broad, deep base of people who are tremendously exciting. And then the second thing the Obama campaign did is they took that broad base and they invested in organization to turn that base and harness its power into an organization that was going out to talk to voters and win the election for them. So again, it starts with the candidate, that inspiration and excitement, and then secondly, it starts with a really good organizing plan that turns that excitement into actual activity to help you win.
So for those that were left November 5th feeling like there was a loss in their life because they didn't have the campaign to work for anymore, as so many did so fervently, here's an opportunity for you to get out in front and lead as a candidate, or to get behind the scenes and operate as a manager, or to take your issue number one, and find a way to organize around it so you can make a change in that issue, and really be the change you want to see in the world, to quote Gandhi.
Yeah, exactly, and it's actually that third part, the get behind an issue movement right now, that's actually probably the most important piece at this very moment, because there's so much on our plate as a country, and Barack Obama is just one person. He is, you know, the president, but there's going to be a lot of, he'll be pushed and pulled in a lot of directions, and so we need to make sure that Congress is also held accountable, that the movement continues to push on Washington. So absolutely, find an organization that is working on an issue that you believe in, and call them up and show up and say that you were involved in the Obama campaign and you now want to use those skills to help pass this issue. And then also think about yourself as a candidate. We often don't, you know, and it's sort of it's just not something that people wake up in the morning and say, hey, I think I'm going to run for office. But we have to challenge some people to do that because we need more people. And we're not a Democratic, you know, we're not a wing of the Democratic Party. We're interested in really good progressives leading, regardless of party. So it's not a partisan thing. It's, you know, these are elected offices, and the people in those offices are making decisions that affect our lives. Let's make sure we have our people, people out of our communities, in those positions.
Well, I've got Jeff Blodgett, our guest. He is the executive director of Wellstone Action, online at wellstone.org. And I have a Camp Wellstone coming to my backyard in a couple of weeks. But for those that don't have a Camp Wellstone coming to their backyard, how can they use the resources of Wellstone Action to get themselves empowered on one of these tracks?
Sure. Well, go to our website, and if you're interested in finding out trainings that are coming to your area, sign up for our email list, and we will notify you of our training schedule for 2009. We're still getting that set up yet, but we're going to keep going with this work because now more than ever, it's sort of a seize-the-moment opportunity for us. So one thing is to watch our training schedule to see if there's a training coming to you. We try to take it around the country. We don't have our own little school here. We take it out on the road. So watch for that. And then we also have a lot of other resources on our website. It's a place where people can continue to learn about the skills involved in effective political work. So take a look at the materials on the website. We also just came out with a new book. It's a book that we use in our trainings. It's called Winning Your Election, The Wellstone Way. It's a comprehensive guide for candidates and campaign workers. It takes you through all the steps of building a winning campaign. And that book you can find online at our website and also in bookstores.
I am in awe, Jeff Blodgett, of... I'm just in awe of the legacy of Senator Paul Wellstone. Who could have... He never could have imagined what he began so many years ago in Minnesota now.
I think that's right. And, you know, we missed his voice deeply when we lost him. We missed his voice in the country. This was right after, you know, he died right after voting against authorizing the use of authorizing George Bush to go to war in Iraq. And we desperately missed his voice for the last 6 years. So I'm now, for the first time, feeling really hopeful about the country. And that, but Paul Wellstone's legacy now is the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who have decided in the last 6 years, yeah, this is my democracy too, and I'm going to step forward and make a difference.
It's amazingly empowering, and for those that are felt with that loss on November 5th of what to do now, I think one of the directions I would point to, because it's been so helpful to me, is Wellstone Action. If there's a Camp Wellstone coming to your town, don't miss it, and check it out online, wellstone.org. What's the name of the new book again, Jeff?
It's called Winning Your Election the Wellstone Way.
I had the workbook. Now I've got to go out and get it. Winning the Election the Wellstone Way.
Yes, that's right.
Jeff Blodgett, Executive Director of Wellstone Action online at wellstone.org. I want to thank you for all your work, sir, and the sea change that we are now seeing across the country. Thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, thank you very much.
My name is Lee Rayburn. I'm sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio. When we continue, we'll take your calls at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
You're listening to guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman.
To those who are huddled around radios in the forgotten corners of the world, our stories are singular, but our destiny is shared. The new dawn of American leadership is at hand.
52 minutes after the hour, my name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today, and I get to do what Tom Hartman does. I'm kind of excited about this. Joining us now from the Talk Radio News Service online at talkradionews.com, Ellen Ratner. Ellen, it is a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to speak to you, and I'm sure Tom is delighted that somebody like you could fill in for him.
Well, I there's so much going on today, Ellen, and I want to get to all of it, but what are you looking at today at the talkradionews.com?
Well, I think what we're really looking at is this whole bailout bill and Henry Paulson being completely under the gun. He was had a bit of a hard time today, let's put it this way, at the Capitol. And I think that the House Financial Services Committee, this is Barney Frank's committee, held this hearing on the Troubled Assets Relief Program called TARP. And Barney Frank opened the hearing today. He said, we were asked last September by the Secretary of the Treasury, supported by the Chairman of the Reserve, to pass an extraordinary piece of legislation. And he said, it was a necessary response, so we thought, to the crisis. And then he said he has two areas that concern him. One, how some of the banks have spent their bailout money and how the TARP money has not been spent on foreclosure prevention.
In fact, Ellen, if I'm not mistaken, you've got some strange political bedfellows in this one, as Senators Chuck Grassley and James Imhoff from Oklahoma and Iowa, respectively, as well as independent Senator Bernie Sanders, a socialist, have all come out and said, we want to account for what has been spent of this money so far, and we want to know whether or not Goldman Sachs got the sweetest deal of them all because of the former chairman now sitting as our Treasury Secretary.
Yes, and believe it or not, that was really begun by Inhofe, who just went bananas.
That is interesting. At the same time today, we've got the big three auto manufacturers going up and asking for $25 billion in a bailout. Otherwise, they're facing bankruptcy and restructuring.
That's right. Well, Paul Kanjorski, a Democrat, asked Paulson about the auto industry also, and he said, do you consider the loss of the American auto industry a significant and systematic risk, don't you? if we lose 3 million jobs, how much would it cost to make up? How about the loss of revenue, et cetera? And Paulson then went on to the purpose of TARP to prevent financial collapse, and he said that he was, you know, concerned about it, but he also said it wouldn't be a good thing. It would be something to be avoided. I mean, this guy sounding like a politician.
Wow. So bailing out Goldman Sachs is necessary because they're too big to fail, but bailing out General Motors, hey, that's just the capitalism working.
Well, you know, a lot of people think, of course, that they're very prejudiced because it deals with unions, the big U word.
And Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News, if there were the big three were forced into bankruptcy, what would that mean for union workers and union contracts?
You know, again, obviously it would have to be negotiated by the bankruptcy court and what happens with their assets, so nobody knows what a bankruptcy court would do. And, of course, the question is, would they just file under Chapter 7, Chapter 11? You know, Chapter 11 is obviously very different than Chapter 7, and those are the kinds of issues that would come up with any kind of major bankruptcy court.
And where does it look right now in the big three bailout? As I heard, it's going to be a slim chance that it will pass.
Well, I think it is at this point in a lame duck Congress, maybe not. But the question is, what are they going to do with it in the long run? And what would be the strictures that they would put up? Don't forget, I mean, you have two pretty heavy duty senators from Michigan, Levin and Stabenow, who have a lot, Stabenow somewhat in leadership, and they are not about to let their state go beyond the tubes. In fact, I was just talking to an accountant 2 minutes, who often gives me sort of advice and what's going on and financially. I really trust this guy in terms of his knowledge of the political scene. And he said, look, you got municipal bonds in places like Michigan, and the people are freaking out, the bond raiders, et cetera, that they won't be able to meet their municipal bonds. You know, the municipalities in a place like that will go broke.
Well, and Ellen Ratner, one of the things that has been floated by the Obama transition team is whether or not to bail out municipalities here in the next big bailout package that is to come. We shall see. Ellen Ratner from Talk Radio News Service, online at talkradionews.com. What a pleasure to speak with you, Ellen. Thank you so much
for your
time this afternoon. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. When we continue, we'll take your calls and we'll take a look at our little aurocracy. It's like democracy, only more explosively. Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman. 866-303-2270. You are listening to Air America Radio.
This is guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Thanks for joining us for the ride here on Air America Radio at 866-303-2270. Speaking with Ellen Ratner before the top of the hour, detailing what the big three are doing on Capitol Hill today. The three major U.S. auto manufacturers took a trip to Capitol Hill to ask for a bailout. Heck, everybody else is doing it. The chairman and CEOs of General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler testifying right now in front of the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, as it looks like it is a slim to none chance that they'll get that bailout opportunity, which means there is a greater chance that some of our auto manufacturers may be filing for bankruptcy in the months to come. Ford announced Tuesday it's selling off 20% of stake in its Japanese partner Mazda in order to raise a quick $500 million cash in order to stay solvent. In order to keep going, basically, they had to sell off part of the company. I wonder if Goldman Sachs was forced to sell off part of their financial interests in order to keep going. No, I don't think so. Ford CEO Alan Mulally, according to the Associated Press today, argued in advance of the hearing that his company's already been trying to transform the business into a more profitable one that meets the 21st century demands for fuel-efficient vehicles. Sure, gas has dropped down to a price now where it's almost affordable again. But if you think that's going to stick around, I've got some gas I'd like to sell you. I just don't think it's possible. And the talk that Barack Obama has made, I believe, is more than just talk as president-elect moving us into this green economy, albeit 8 years too late. But we're getting there. And are we going to do that with our own auto manufacturers, or are we going to have to rely on autos from around the world? Are we going to be able to work with the big auto manufacturing companies and the CEOs in Detroit? No, they don't live in Detroit. Are we kidding? Auburn Hills, I believe, right around that area, where the palace is. Listen, we've got a lot of work to do, and I don't think cutting our losses and starting new, especially when it comes to automobiles, is necessarily the best idea, regardless of how they've acted in the past, regardless of how they pushed the big SUVs, the suburban utility vehicles, and the big Hummers on us, even granting tax breaks for buying Hummers in the Bush administration. That, I believe, is coming to an end. Let's go to the phones at 866-303-2270. Robert in L.A., you're on the Tom Hartman Show on Air America Radio.
Thanks for taking my call. From the very beginning of this bailout, I always thought that what we really need is a truth and reconciliation commission set up like they did in South Africa to get the offenders from apartheid to just come forward without penalty and just say, you know, this is what we did wrong. We're willing to confess it. Now let's move on. I mean,
problem with that, Robert, is I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, I saw the CEO of General Motors about a month ago on the Colbert Report on Comedy Central, and he still poo-poos the idea of global warming. He still thinks that his creation of alternative fuel vehicles or flex fuel or hybrids and the electric Volt that the GM's planning on, he still thinks that's just...
That's fine, but if we can hinge the bailout money, it's like, we know you need the bailout money, you know you need it, we know. We know that you did wrong, you know you did wrong. We're going to say, hey, come before the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, tell the people, eat some humble pie, and then your money will come. I mean, the public just wants to be dealt straight with. I don't care whether you're AIG or whether you are a subprime broker pumping out bad mortgages. Everybody was in on it, and everybody's got something to confess. So let's just say, let bygones be bygones, but here's the truth, and then let's reconcile our situation.
But, Robert, how are we going to have a come-to-Jesus moment when these folks worship the almighty dollar at the sacrifice of everything else?
If you were on the committee right now in front of those guys and you said, hey, we don't want to give it to you, but hey, how about you guys come before, we're going to set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you come hat in hand, tell us what you did wrong, if we think you're sincere, we'll give it to you.
There's a little schadenfreude there for me, Robert, and as much as I would love the you grovel, you get down and grovel.
You're too cynical. These people can be brought to understand that a little humble pie doesn't taste so bad, especially when you want to keep, your company from going under and looking like an idiot to your children and your grandchildren.
Well, and I really don't care about the CEOs. They're going to be set, as are their children and grandchildren. My concern are about the retirees, the auto workers, the UAW employees who are now relying on the pension and whether or not that pension might be swept out from under them in any sort of bankruptcy restructuring that we might see. I appreciate it.
Everybody can come forward. Regulators can come forward. Everybody from the government can come forward. Everybody's got a piece and confession that they need to do. And maybe once it's all out there, like a Wikipedia, we can kind of piece together how never to let it happen again. That's
what a great idea. And Robert,
Reconciliation Commission, I tell you.
My mother always warned me, you can be skeptical, but don't get cynical. But, Robert, I would have to say, you probably need to get a little more skeptical. it's a great idea. I just don't know if it'll come to pass. Harvey in Berkeley, you're on Air America Radio. Good afternoon.
Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Thanks for the show. I'd like to see General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler survive. I think that it's a great institution, and it can be turned around. Why destroy that infrastructure when it can be turned around? And what I'd like to see is that they get the money, but they get it with stipulations. And the stipulation, like, first of all, right now they're addicted to oil. They just cannot get oil. It's like watching junkies over drugs or something like that. And I propose the clean energy combo, and this would be one or more, that they start manufacturing electric cars, and that one or more electric cars be sold in combination with a solar electric rooftop installation.
Whoa.
All the rebates, all the tax incentives rolled into a bundle. It would reduce the cost of the loan on both objects independently. And once they get the rooftop and the car, they're pumping sunshine instead of Chevron, and they reduce their carbon footprint all one step. And right now, for instance, in Korea, they've just developed a new lithium-ion battery that's 80 or 90% more efficient than the lithium-ion batteries that exist now. You can go to Google, put in the word Korea lithium-ion battery, hit the search button and then news button and read all about it. So we now have the power, and I say that we can power our cars off the sunshine, and that would be a way to really turn our global warming situation around, slow global warming rapidly. General Motors, I think the people, Chrysler and Ford, the people are hungry for electric cars, and,
yeah.
and I think that they would it would sell like hotcakes, and this is one way. So I would like to see the clean energy combo installed, and it would also be good for both the energy companies and General Motors because they can advertise each other's products. So it would be a synergistic effect.
Well, why not put a little wind turbine up there as well?
We could
power some stuff with just a tiny wind turbine. Maybe that'll take care of the car radio.
Well, it's open to options. There's actually millions of ideas for the enhancement and reducing the energy consumption and the use of cars.
But so, Harvey, like a junkie, they only see one way, and it's the same way they've been going down, and it's a straight road to their demise. And it's interesting that you bring up the parallel between an addict and our auto manufacturers with gasoline. I have watched friends of mine kill themselves with heroin, and I've watched it happen. And it's funny how we're literally killing the planet with our commitment to being a car culture without any sort of nod to the need for change right now, yesterday.
Yeah, so I say let's get solar and let's turn our economy around, and I think Barack Obama's the man to do it, and General Motors and Ford, I'm with you all the way. Just need to turn around and get rid of your addiction.
Thanks, and I'm with you, Harvey. Thank you for the call. Let's go to AC in Bradenton, Florida. AC, you're on the Tom Hartman Show on Air America Radio.
Thank you. I think that they're going to fail infinitely anyway, or ultimately, excuse me, I correct myself, because the rules of trade internationally, Americans are never, ever going to be able to compete with 10 cents on the dollar China labor. That's never going to happen.
Couldn't we start, though, by taking a look at how much money we're spending on health care per car and try to eliminate that cost and see if we can be more cost effective? I mean, it sounds like you're ready to cut your losses now and run, AC.
No, it's just, you know, why would you keep giving somebody that's dying with a heroin addiction more heroin?
Well,
I mean, you can say that that's being compassionate, but is it really? Is it really for their interest to keep
doing
that?
The smack analogy is about gasoline and not about automobiles. It's about that our big three are actually hooked on gasoline and whether or not we can wean them off it. And maybe we need an intervention here. Maybe this needs to be like an A&E series where we step in and say, you know what, we love you, which is why we want you to change. Listen, coming from a blue-collar background, coming from, low, mid-income neighborhoods where I've lived my entire life, I know the importance of those jobs, and it's not, again, the CEOs I worry about. It's the auto dealers. It's the automakers. It's the union workers. It's all the periphery jobs and industries that surround it.
But the problem is, how many warnings have they had since 73? And it's the whole...
You're right.
The problem here is, like, you're building this high-rise, and you're 30 floors up. And the structure's flawed, and the engineers are saying there's cracks, it's crumbling, and you say, give us more money, we're going to go 40 stories. It'll get better. So, I mean, listen, you know, it's the health care. Okay, I was just watching CNN.
Yeah,
and
that's what I've been saying.
Like, we're spending $2,000 almost per car,
yep.
And all the other competitors globally have national health care. So
let's start there. Before AC, you decide we're going to scrap the entire automobile industry.
No, I don't want to do that. I didn't say that. We need a massive restructuring and reinvigoration of the concept of what constitutes manufacturing. And the CEOs, pardon my language, but the hell with the CEOs.
That's language we can take. AC, I'm out of time, but I appreciate the call. It's something worth talking about. More importantly, it's something worth debating. Because where do we draw the line then? I mean, when Walmart comes running and says, geez, it was a terrible holiday season, we're going to need a bailout. What do you say to that? Where do you draw the line? And for me, because I know people in the auto industry, for me, because I know the union workers that are at risk here with their pension being swept out from underneath them if there was a bankruptcy restructuring. For me, I want to save them. It's not about the CEOs, and maybe it's not so much even about the big three auto manufacturers. It's about the real lives and the real effects on those real lives, real people that I know, and I think you do as well. And it's about helping them. That's where I'm coming from, and it's that simple for me because I'm not smart enough to make it any more complicated than that. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today, 866-303-2270. You're listening to Air America Radio.
You're listening to Lee Rayburn, filling in on the Tom Hartman program.
The true strength of our nation comes not from the might of our arms, but from the enduring power of our ideals. Democracy, liberty, opportunity, and unyielding hope.
It's 22 minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today on Air America Radio. I want to get to, listen, I know that what's happening on Capitol Hill today is getting a lot of attention, with Senator Lieberman able to retain his chairmanship of the Senate Homeland Security Committee. I know the big three are on Capitol Hill today asking, pleading, begging for a bailout. And I know that Henry Paulson has been called to account in House committee hearings today about where that bailout money has gone. However, at the very top, you know, there is this interconnection of all things, and sometimes it becomes completely apparent, like the trillion-dollar wars we are spending that we didn't need to get into in the first place. Of course, I'm speaking about our bureaucracy. It's like democracy, only you get the rest. And the agreement signed yesterday by U.S. Ambassador Ryan Crocker and the Iraqi Foreign Minister Hoshyar Zebari. This agreement is the agreement which extends the troops, U.S. troops in Iraq all the way through the end of 2011. It gives a three-year timetable to withdraw all of our troops out of Iraq, and it puts caveats in place so that there are more protections for Iraqis, like giving Iraqis control of the Green Zone and other American-held areas, like allowing Iraqis to search through incoming American cargo. I thought that one raised a bit of a red flag for me the other day, and I was trying to figure out why do Iraqis want to go through American cargo, and why haven't they had that opportunity in the past? And the truth is that the reason Iraqis want to go through American cargo coming into Iraq is because, well, according to ABC News, they found guns being shipped into Iraq in bags of dog food that the now infamous mercenary group Blackwater has been shipping in. This is a federal grand jury investigation in North Carolina, and right now they're investigating allegations, according to ABC News, that Blackwater illegally has shipped assault rifles and silencers into Iraq. And according to one source in the story, you know, the only reason you send silencers to someone is for assassination. That's the only reason. And it evidently they shipped, the Blackwater shipped these illegal assault weapons, silencers, and other accoutrements for our mercenaries in Iraq. They shipped them in large sacks of dog food. Six Blackwater employees are now under investigation by another federal grand jury in D.C. in connection with the shooting deaths of at least 17 civilians. I wonder if they used silencers. This is back in September of last year at a Baghdad traffic stop. The alleged dog food smuggling scheme, it began last year, when two Blackwater employees were caught trying to sell stolen weapons in North Carolina. Two former employees told ABC News that they witnessed the dog food smuggling operation firsthand. Weapons were actually buried inside large bags of dog food at the company headquarters in North Carolina and then sent to Iraq for the company's bomb-sniffing dogs there. They've got an arsenal of bomb-sniffing dogs, which must not be able to sniff out the assault weapons in their own dog food. This includes M4 assault weapons. These were big weapons that were put on shipping pallets by Blackwater, surrounded by stacks of dog food bags. Then the entire pallet was shrink-wrapped and then sent off to Iraq, where these illegal weapons ended up. And I saw another story the other day. 1% of the weapons right now in the ongoing occupation of Iraq are from Iranians. Remember when George W. Bush tried to float that trial balloon that it's the Iranians that are causing all the consternation in Iraq? Really, you ought to look in the mirror, Mr. President, because it's us. In a statement, Blackwater had this to say: all firearms shipped to Iraq by Blackwater were given proper U.S. government license. In the same token, they also denied even owning or possessing any M4 assault weapons in Iraq, the ones that were so big that they didn't fit in the dog food and had to be placed on pallets surrounded by dog food. U.S. Army officials tell ABC News, or actually said this earlier this year, at least one Blackwater M4 weapon was discovered during a raid on an insurgent location in Iraq. Let me be clear. This is a private mercenary force, which a grand jury investigation is now trying to figure out if they illegally shipped their weapons in dog food into Iraq. One U.S. Army official speaking on the condition of anonymity told ABC News that an M4 weapon from Blackwater was actually discovered not with the U.S. military and not with our mercenary forces, but rather with insurgents in Iraq. That's the fear here. that we're actually arming the enemy with our big assault weapons that our mercenaries are smuggling in without any oversight, without any threat of prosecution. That will change under the new agreement as well as, well, this also goes without saying, the change of the timetable. Remember when George W. Bush wouldn't agree to a timetable? Never agree to a timetable. And anybody that agreed to a timetable was raising the white flag of surrender. Well, George W. has raised that white flag of surrender now, and we will have our troops out by 2011. If Barack Obama has his way, it'll be much sooner than that. 16 months, and he's sticking to it, as he told Steve Croft on 60 Minutes Sunday night. 866-303-2270. My name is Lee Rayburn, singing for Tom Hartman today. You're listening to Air America Radio.
This is Lee Rayburn, guest hosting on the Tom Hartman Program.
We have never been just a collection of red states and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America. Yes.
Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman today on the Tom Hartman Show here on Air America Radio. My next guest is the Executive Director of National Write Your Congressman. It is a nonpartisan group meant to get you empowered in our political process. You can find out more online at NWYC.com. That just stands for National Write Your Congressman. Please welcome to the show Randy Ford. Good afternoon, Randy.
Hello, Lee. How are you?
Well, you know, I think on November 5th, a lot of people who are like-minded like me, who were excited about the Barack Obama campaign, felt that they were missing something the morning after the election. And that is this empowerment that people were feeling with campaigns. And I know you're a nonpartisan group, but there was left on the left this sense of, what do we do now? And one of the, actually a listener suggested to me, National Write Your Congressman, which is now 50 years old. Happy 50th, Randy.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about this campaign that you do.
Well, thank you, Lee. And basically what we're involved in is educating the American people on the issues of the day, the important issues. And as you said, we do it in a nonpartisan way. We give both the Democratic and Republican viewpoint on bills that are active in Congress. But more importantly, Lee, we move them to action. There's an awful lot of information that's out there and available to people. You can spend endless hours on the Internet, certainly. But at the end of the day, very few people actually turn that into action and actually communicate directly their personal opinion into their congressperson's office in Washington, D.C., and that's the business that we're in and the business we've been in for 50 years.
And, Randy, you know, I remember working as a grassroots organizer about 12 years ago in San Francisco, going door to door. And the thing we always kept in mind is that there is an equation in elected officials' offices where they equate a certain number of each letters to a certain number of votes that they'll actually get or not get because of a certain issue.
Well, that is so true. And you know, one of the fallacies that that we try to squelch out there, Lee, is the fact that people don't think that their voice matters, that their vote matters, that their opinion matters inside the halls of Congress. And I've heard literally hundreds of testimonials over the years directly from elected officials in Washington how important it is to them to hear directly from the people back home.
Then, Randy Ford, where does this myth come from that your message to your elected official doesn't mean anything? How have we been so disempowered in this process?
Well, I think first and foremost, very few people actually do participate. Apathy is kind of our number one competitor out in the marketplace. So I think it begins there, and you know, you can argue one way or the other, I guess, you know, how the media plays into that. But I'll tell you, for those that do get engaged, that do get involved, they do get correspondence back from their elected officials in Washington, they do feel very empowered, and they'll do it over and over again. Studies have shown, Lee, that if you do it once or even twice, you develop a habit, and then people will develop a consistent dialogue with their elected officials, and they so much need that, particularly with the issues that this new administration, this new Congress, and this new White House is going to face and what's in their laps today.
From the economy to foreign policy, all these issues directly affect your back pocket, your wallet, your purse, your life, and your freedoms for that matter. And while you talk about, Randy, you know, you can spend hours on the Internet boning up on an issue, The truth is, these days, you can spend 3 or 4 minutes typing an email to your elected official and get the desired result.
Absolutely. And the congressman's offices, that they prefer, that is their preferred mode of communication. I think that's another fallacy. So, I just do an email, I'm going to go out in cyberspace, and it'll, you know, I don't even know if it gets to the congressperson's office, et cetera. But they are set up, they have software, they have everything geared up in their offices to communicate with via email. A lot of them will respond back quickly the same way.
And more than just communicating back, it's also getting results as they tally those numbers and they add up what their constituents think and what they believe about the issues. They know they've got to run for re-election like everybody else.
Absolutely, particularly in the House where they have to run every 2 years. And I had a congressman tell me recently, Lee, that probably somewhere between 40% to 50% of the time he will vote, you know, his conscience, he will vote his ideology by which he ran for office and by which he was elected by his constituents. But the vast majority, or at least 50% of the time and sometimes more, he absolutely needs input from the constituents back home on how this pending legislation is going to affect their lives, their businesses, their families.
And what tools do you have available at your website for the National Write Your Congressman organization online at nwyc.com? What tools do you have there to make the process accessible for everybody?
Well, we do a variety of things, Lee. Probably first and foremost is we put out constituent ballots. We focus on several issues throughout the year that are pending in Congress, and they vary. We do not have a legislative agenda, just whatever the big issues are of the day, whether it be health care reform, immigration, Social Security, of course, of late, the economy and bailouts and stimulus packages and all that type of thing. Whatever the topical issues are of the day, we research it. We stick with factual information coming out of both the Republican and Democratic side, and get these alerts and these ballots into the hands of our customers so that they can then express their personal opinion directly into the congressman's office.
And Randy
Ford, also have customized research. We'll research other issues that are pertinent to that particular individual or the industry that their business might be involved in.
Randy Ford, you talked about the reaction from congressmen to the work of the National Write Your Congressman. However, what about some of the reactions you received from people who have used the tools at NWYC.com to get involved with their political process?
Well, I think you mentioned the key word earlier, Lee, and that is they feel empowered. They feel like their voice does matter, and they get confirmation of that from correspondence back from their elected officials. And they're also engaged. I mean, they're engaged with the issues of the day, which is so important. You know, in years past, the old NIMBY effect, you know, it's not in my backyard, therefore I don't care. The issues of today are in everyone's backyard, more so than we ever probably hoped and wished, particularly in the last 60 days.
You bet, and it's a small world after all, and it's only getting smaller.
Absolutely. And so that empowerment, and, you know, we have elections as we sit here today, yeah, literally hanging in the balance by less than a couple hundred votes. And so if you tell people in Minnesota or Alaska or some of these other states that they're, you know, one or two or their attempt to go to the poll and their vote didn't matter, you've got minuscule results, you know, deciding some of these elections. And same things happen on Capitol Hill on very key votes in Congress. Sometimes one or two congresspersons can sway a huge bill. And quite often, personal testimonials from home, and sometimes they're actually read or talked about on the House or Senate floor, these personal stories and testimonials from people back home that took the time to write in will sway their opinion.
Randy Ford, our guest, Executive Director of National Write Your Congressman, online at nwyc.com. You know, I want to write one letter. I want to write it to my congresswoman, and I want to let her know how I feel about the bailouts going on. But more than that, I want my five friends who we all shared beers with and nodded heads in agreement about it, I want them to write their congressman or congressperson as well. How do we create a campaign around the National Write Your Congressman?
Well, we have a lot of a good majority of our customers, Lee, currently are business owners, and that's an excellent illustration you gave, because what they do is they'll get a lot of their employees involved in doing this. It may or may not involve sitting around having a beer, but in any event, they may be in the employee break room, or a lot of our business owners will copy the information that they receive from us and encourage their employees, and they may live in two or three different congressional districts. They will encourage their employees to get involved on an issue that very well may be affecting their company.
So
you know, we have a lot of people that do that.
It's interesting to think of it in terms of a multiplicative effect, that if you find four people that agree with you that will also take the time, the 5 minutes it takes to zip off an email to their congressperson, you've just multiplied your voice times five.
Absolutely.
And the result
is... There's one thing that Congress understands, and that is power in numbers.
and you know, I think the greatest myth ever perpetrated on us is that we are alone, there's nothing we can do about it, we are disempowered, and this democracy has no place for you. And the truth is that the exact opposite is the fact, that we are empowered to take this thing over anytime we want to, that we do have a say in it, and we can take it... I mean, it's ours. It belongs to us.
Well, this country wasn't founded on we the lobbies; it was we the people. But only if we choose to do our part as citizens and be engaged and involved.
It's a democracy if you want it.
Absolutely.
It's an interesting point of view, Randy, and I want to thank you for being here. Randy Ford, our guest, from the Executive Director of the National Write Your Congressman campaign, online at nwyc.com. And, Randy, here's to 50 more years, sir. Thank you very much for your time and your empowerment this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me, Lee.
nwyc.com, again, is the website. Check it out online. Get empowered yourself. One person can make the difference. Will that one person be you? Written on the Underground Railroad Museum walls in Cincinnati, if not you, who? If not now, when? Lee Rayburn sitting in for Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
You're listening to guest host Lee Rayburn, filling in for Tom Hartman.
Because of what we did on this day, in this election, at this defining moment, change has come to America.
It's 49 minutes after the hour. My name is Lee Rayburn, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. I want to thank you for being along for the ride of the best 3 hours of my day, an opportunity to speak with the entire country, and it has been a pleasure. At 866-303-2270, we wrap up the show with you this afternoon, and we start with Anna in Greeley, Colorado. Good afternoon, Anna. You're on the Tom Hartman Show on Air America Radio.
Hi, Lee. How you
Hi.
Doing?
Good, thank you.
Well, I just listened to the last speaker there. I've been writing... whoever was in Congress for me for many years, calling on the phone, sending email. I'm retired, but I'm a computer technician, so, you know, I do that. So it's never done any good. I'm afraid to take your hope from you, but it's never done any good. I'm wondering what Barack Obama is going to protect and defend when he takes his oath of office. Where's the Constitution?
Well, that is a good question, because the one thing that the Obama transition team has been tight-lipped about, Anna, is that whether or not they're going to repeal the domestic warrantless wiretapping. One of the things they've been upfront about is that they're going to close Guantanamo Bay and make sure that we do not torture in this country. The other thing we know is that they are not going to look backward and look to prosecute the people that paved the way for the unconstitutional acts of the executive branch of our federal government over the last 8 years.
I know, and we have no habeas corpus. We have so the dictator can just point to you and say, go to prison.
Oh, but we got a good dictator this time, don't we?
Yeah, I don't know.
Is there such a thing?
Yeah, I voted for Cynthia McKinney myself. But
Who is your congressperson that never answers an email, a phone call?
He answers. Ken Salazar. Answers with some old big excuse about he's a blue dog Democrat, like a bunch of them are. I don't understand what could he say to me. I mean,
is it possible that you may be in the minority in your constituency, or is it possible that you may just have more letters written in opposing viewpoints than you put out as a proponent?
Everybody I know, I try not to know the right-wing nuts who live here, but I do run into them from time to time, and they have no idea about the Constitution. They think the really important thing is
the Bible.
It's the Declaration of Independence and the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, the Declaration of Independence was a declaration of war.
Right.
And it has nothing to do with the country.
But that may explain a lot of where they're coming from.
Maybe.
Hey, listen, Anna, I appreciate the call, and I don't want to discourage you from trying, and there are some Congress critters out there that will reject outright or may not put the same weight on what their constituents say. But in the hour previous, we had Camp Wellstone on, and Wellstone Action. And their message is, hey, listen, if your congressperson isn't listening, run. And you can run on the simple campaign slogan that you will listen, that you would be responsive to your constituents, and the reason you're running is because this elected official hasn't listened. It is a great opportunity to become a part of the process, and I think it's a launching pad. If your writing in doesn't work, well then, damn it, run. Alex in Michigan, you're on Air America Radio.
Hi, Lee. Good to talk to you.
Pleasure's mine, sir.
Yeah, I want to weigh in on the auto aid package being discussed right now.
Where in Michigan are you?
I'm Detroit area.
Okay.
I work in Warren and live in Plymouth.
So you know what's come to pass in that economy for the last 25, 30 years.
Right, and there's a reason for that. And the basic reason is trade and economic policies that favor importing manufactured goods instead of making them here.
Yeah,
you could look at the TV and radio industry. That's gone. You could look at consumer goods. That's gone.
But Alex, why did it leave? What made America so uncompetitive as a manufacturing sector?
Well, when you get away from having a level playing field with tariffs, how are we supposed to? How am I supposed to compete with somebody who will do a job for 10 cents an hour? You know,
well, you can't. Unless you're willing to pay somebody 9 cents an hour, and in that case, I think you would be. And here's, you know, and we've signed these free trade agreements, and many Democrats have gone along with them. But what these free trade agreements have done is created part of the unfair playing field that we're currently operating under. That the trade agreements paved the way for no labor protections in these countries like China. That they paved the way for no environmental protections in countries like China, where they have a new coal-fired power plant every week. And as well, in every developed nation but ours, the health care is covered by the government. They've created the largest insurance pool possible by putting the entire nation inside of it, and it has saved somewhere between $1,500 and $2,000 for every car manufactured outside the United States. No way you can compete against that.
Right, and the problem is that it's all the job loss here that basically created the fiscal crisis, not the other way around.
I agree.
Because if we had money, we wouldn't have to take out upside-down mortgages, and
right,
we'd pay things off as we go.
We wouldn't be spending more than we're making, which is the nation we have become within the last couple of years.
Right.
That we've become a creditor's nation. And I think this is the crux of your argument, Alex, and I would say that we are at this critical point where we can decide to race to the bottom and we can work towards that 9 cents an hour job that would bring manufacturing back, or we can try to be the rising tide that lifts all boats and try to find a way where we create trade agreements that aren't necessarily free but are downright fair, that protect workers around the world, that protects our environment and the air that we all have to breathe no matter where the smokestack is located. I think this is where we start, and I don't want to be the nation that decides to race towards the bottom, but rather the nation that says to the rest of the world, workers deserve a living wage, they deserve workplace safety protections, and we deserve air that we can breathe and water that we can drink.
I agree, and just one last point is that in 1980, Chrysler got a loan guarantee. They paid it back early, and they paid it back with interest, and with help, we'll turn this industry around. And to all the progressives, the UAW is the most progressive union out there, and let's support one another.
I absolutely agree, Alex, and here's the danger that if we don't do something, New Orleans, and you're calling from around Detroit, the Detroit area, if we don't do anything, that New Orleans won't be the only city to die under the Bush administration. Thank you for the call. We'll wrap up the show this afternoon with Ed, who's been hanging on forever. I think you were on the line before I even got started here, Ed.
Yeah, something like that.
Thanks for hanging on, bud.
I'll get this quick because time is short. The last 8 years, our country has been under the control of a criminal conspiracy. You know, they got in by cheating in the election and then using basically pulling a judicial coup with the Supreme Court. They've basically been enriching their corporate buddies. They look at the national treasury as a big pot of money to be stolen and given out to their buddies.
Look at our oil energy policy, our energy policy, period.
Our oil energy, look at what happened in Katrina, you know, in terms
Enron.
Of FEMA being outsourced. Look at the war in Iraq. Look at you know,
it's,
I mean,
been hell. They've been,
and look at Goldman Sachs, you know, sucking up the money now. I mean, it's going on even in the last days of this thing. And basically, the majority of us have been victims for the last 8 years. And you were talking about healing at the start. The healing is not going to even begin to happen until we actually start putting some of these people on trial. And, you know, that's the, if Barack Obama is not willing to do it, then we need to form citizen vigilant committees, start putting up you know, bounties to bring these people to justice at the International Court of Justice or something.
Brother, you make it awfully hard to disagree with you. I think if Barack Obama doesn't do it, maybe Ed should. And if Ed doesn't do it, maybe I will. And if not me, how about you? That'll do it for me today. I do believe we wrap things up by saying, tag, you're it, which is rather fitting given Ed's call. My name is Lee Rayburn. Thank you so much for having me today on the Tom Hartman Show. You're listening to Air America Radio.